Okay, tonight we're going to be in Zechariah chapter 13. Zechariah chapter 13 divides in roughly in half. We have verses 1 through 6, which are going to talk about the false prophets in a future day. Not in the day that Zechariah was in, but a coming time. And then verses 7 through 9, the last three verses, addressing the Messiah, talking about what's going to happen with the Messiah and the cleansing of the people of Israel. And so we start off in verse 1 of chapter 13. It says, and in that day being a reference to, we even went back up to verse 11, and that's the day in which there's great mourning in Jerusalem. Go back up to verse 9. Come about in that day, I will set about to destroy. And then in verse 10, and I will pour out on the house of David. So in that day normally is a reference. You have to always interpret it in context. But normally, if you look in the context, it is a reference to what we call the day of the Lord. Okay. And the day of the Lord, remember, is both the 7 years of Daniel's 70th week, and then the 1,000 years of the kingdom. Most of the time, it's the seven-year part. It's the first part of it that in that day usually refers to. So he says, in that day, a fountain or a spring, okay, not the name that Ion, hook, pin, or peg. That's the Hebrew word. I always remember that. My wife is an Ion, hook, pin, or peg. It's interesting. Peg-a in Greek is spring, and the word spring in Hebrew, Ion, means a hook, pin, or peg, in addition to a spring. I don't know exactly for sure how spring ties out of it, but this is not that word. Okay, all that rambling just to say. This is not that word. This is a different word for a spring. And it says it will be opened for, and it's opened for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and it has to do with sin and uncleanness. Now, this is not the spring that ushers forth in the river of water that comes out from under the temple in Ezekiel, okay? If you were to look in Ezekiel 47, you have a river that goes out, and the further it goes out, it wider and deeper it gets. It just kind of, it's an unnatural situation. Usually rivers, as they get further from their source, become larger, because they have all kinds of tributaries flowing into it. But the one in Ezekiel 47, there are no tributaries flowing into it. It's all fed from under the temple. And this is not the same event. That one is actually one that causes life. It causes the Dead Sea to teem with life. It gives life to the desert. That's what it does. And it's a real physical river. This is talking about a fountain, and I believe that this is figurative here, because it is for the purpose of cleansing from sin and impurity. So this is what he's talking about. Now, the word that's translated impurity, let's back up. The word that's translated fountain in here is used, actually I didn't put down how many times it's used, but it's used in Jeremiah several times. It's used in Jeremiah 2:13, where God asks a question. He says, come, let's talk about this for a minute. Have you ever known a people that have changed their God? He says, well, you've changed me. You've gone and gotten a different God and exchanged this God for false gods. And he compares it to people that have a spring, a natural spring that they can draw water from, and they reject that spring and go and bore a well and get well water out of a well rather than from a spring. Yeah, and that's exactly what it was. They had to really work for these other gods, and that's what he compares it to. So there's one of the words that he uses for a spring. He compares himself to a spring, which he also does in Jeremiah 17:3, when he says Israel has rejected their living spring, Jehovah. And he actually calls himself a spring, and it's a spring that heals them from the sick heart not being physically sick heart, Jeremiah spiritually what? Sick, Jeremiah 17:13. So it's Jeremiah 2:13 and Jeremiah 17:13, a couple of those, And Jeremiah 17:14 then says, God heals heals them by the spring. That is, by he himself heals them from their spiritual problem. Interestingly enough, there is a comparison then between he being a spring of water and the literal water that comes out from under the temple in Ezekiel, which we're told about in Ezekiel, and we're told about in Revelation 22 or 21. Because that river has trees that produce fruits. People eat the fruits, but the leaves of the trees are for healing. And that's for physical healing. This is spiritual healing. So it's one of the ways that you can demonstrate he's not talking about the same thing. It's comparable, but it's not the same. Okay? It's one of the greatest errors or blunders in Bible interpretation is to make similar things identical. It was drilled into my head in seminary. Similarity is not identity, right? We used to talk about that a lot. And it's real easy to look at two things. That looks like this. They look like the same thing. And they're not the same thing. Sometimes you compare them. Always look carefully and go, are there differences? If there's differences, then that's very important. Okay. The illustration that one of my professors in seminary used to use all the time was, he said, I married my wife not just because she's like every other woman, but because of the things that distinguished her from every other woman. What made her different. In other words, the distinctions were important. If the distinctions weren't important, on Sunday, all we'd have to tell husbands is, before you leave today, make sure you grab a wife. But we don't want you to do that. We want you to take your wife home, not somebody else's. See, the distinctions are important. So, we have Jehovah compared to a spring, which this is a spring here opened in that day. That spring deals with sin and impurity. Sin, most of us understand that, but the issue of impurity that he uses, this word for impurity occurs 29 times in the Old Testament. 12 of them, I should put it this way, 12 of them occur in the book of Leviticus, and they refer to a woman's uncleanness during her monthly cycle. It's used that 12 times in the book of Leviticus. One time it's used of a man committing adultery with his sister-in-law, his brother's wife. And that's considered an act of uncleanness. Four times, and then it's used of women's situation two other times outside Leviticus. Four times this word is used of the uncleanness that's involved in worshiping images and idolatry. And in listening in connection then with false prophets. Now I believe if we read the rest, let's read the rest of this here and see now, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but see if this cleansing that God himself is going to produce in the people, if that cleansing, this washing away of this problem, isn't associated with an uncleanness from these people adulterating themselves with false gods, committing idolatry. Okay. So it goes on. And idolatry connected with false prophets. That's what we want to associate with this. And it says in verse 2, and it will come about in that day, declares the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols from the land, and they will no longer be remembered. And I will also remove the prophets and the unclean spirit from the land. Now all those went together. Because an idol was a false god. So you got something over here, you make an idol of a false god. But then you have to, in some way, you have to have a priest or somebody that serves or encourages you to serve this idol. So what you did was you came up with, you had false prophets that gave false prophecies about these things. But if you really want a false prophecy, if you really want false prophets to be convincing, you have to kind of, in some way or another, have them give prophecies that can semi be fulfilled. And so you had then the next part there, unclean spirit from the land. Because what do unclean spirits do? Flip over for just a second, over keeping your finger, flip over to 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4. This is important for you to understand about people that make prophecies and such. Verse 1 says, Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits, prove the spirits to see whether they are from God. Why? Because many false prophets have gone out in the world. So you could have somebody come along to your church, claim to be a prophet of God, and This was at the time that so they were still having prophets doing this, but they could be a false prophet, and they're connected with a false spirit. That'd be a fallen angel, an unclean spirit that wants to produce a false prophecy. And so he gives them, here's the test, by verse 2. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses Jesus Christ has come in flesh is from God. In other words, you had all kinds of false prophets that were prophesying that were saying Jesus hadn't become man. That Jesus wasn't man or wasn't coming back as man. We've got actually all three scenarios within the book of 1 John. I think John's just kind of making a general statement. Test them. What do they say about Jesus Christ? If they're off about what they say about Jesus Christ, even if they give some very convincing prophecies, guess what? They're false prophets. And if they're false prophets, they're unsaved. Because they're giving false prophecies by unclean spirits. Now remember that in the book of Deuteronomy, God gave to Israel, he said that they had a test for a prophet. That is, they were supposed to give a prophecy, and if the prophecy came and was fulfilled in a short time, then you'd believe his prophet. But if he'd give a short-term prophecy and it didn't come, you knew he was a false prophet. But then God had to bring a second warning, a caveat with that. Even if he prophesies something that will happen, but he prophesies something not in keeping with the law, you know he's wrong. If he says, let us go and worship idols. Even if he prophesied that tomorrow you're going to have a flat tire in your car, and guess what? You go out tomorrow, and demons managed to cause you to have a flat tire. You go, that false prophet must have been telling the truth. So now I guess I should go worship false idols because he must be a prophet of God. He says, no. So in both cases, you've got two things going on with a false prophet. They had to give a prophecy that could be fulfilled in the short term to validate whether they were a real prophet. Because it's always easy to give prophecies that are off there in the future. And, you know, they might happen in my lifetime. They might happen in a millennia. Think of it. There's prophecies that were given in the Old Testament that haven't been fulfilled yet. There were prophecies that, a lot of prophecies that have been fulfilled. And so it's always easy for us to think, well, you know, you can make a prophecy. How do you know it's going to be fulfilled? Everything takes so long. Well, every one of those prophets also had to prophesy about something that was in the immediate short term that could be proved to be fulfilled. And see what a demon or an unclean spirit, and you can turn back to Zechariah now, what an unclean spirit did in that then was he made that prophecy convincing because he could go then manipulate circumstances to make it appear that that person actually prophesied something. And God allowed, within the world system, allowed that kind of thing to transpire. With unsaved people. Let's put it this way. Unsaved people, they didn't want to believe the truth even when they're confronted with it. So what difference did it make? This just made it that much more plausible for them. Because in the end, it wasn't about whether or not they could show it immediately. That was less significant even than whether what they prophesied was consistent with the Word of God. So all of these go together. Back in Zechariah 13:2, all these go together. That is, he cuts off the idol. From the land, he removes the prophet and the unclean spirit. In the book of Revelation, you have a false prophet. You also have false prophets that Jesus warned about. And in in Revelation chapter 18, one of the things that he says about the city Babylon is it was a city that was filled with unclean birds and unclean spirits. What are all those unclean spirits doing there? They're speaking through people. They're giving false prophecies. They're misleading. They're leading astray the nations. So Zechariah then, chapter 13, verse 3, as this goes on, he says, and it will come about that if anyone then still prophesies. So in other words, he says, you still have these false prophets that are running around doing this. Then his mother and father who gave birth to him will say, you shall not live. For you have spoken falsely in the name of the Lord. And his father and mother who gave birth to him, they will pierce him through when he prophesies. Not stoning. Run him through with a spear. They're going to do it. In other words, mom and dad are going to do what they should have done in the Old Testament. That was actually, if you understand it, that was one of the things that was built into the law, I think, to really show people how hard it was to keep the law. Because the thing, if you had a child that was rebellious, who is responsible for bringing that child on charges to have that child put to death? Mom and dad were. That would have been hard. I don't know that I could have done that. I mean, it's easy sometimes if you get really hacked off with your kid going, yeah, we're in the Old Testament in Estonia. Not that my kids were ever like that, but not that not that my kids ever pushed my buttons that much. But you get the point. That would have been a really hard decision to make. But that was what was necessary. And you know the problem is, when you tolerate problems like that, it just makes things worse and worse. And pretty soon you're like in our culture right now. Man, you can't hardly do anything to a kid today. And the result of it is, do you think behavior in our kids in the school systems, does it all seem like it's better than it was back in the day when you actually could make kids mind? Sort of doesn't look like it to me. So my wife says one of the hardest things about trying to teach school this day is it's hard to control the kids. She's pretty good at it. She knows. She's gotten pretty clever at figuring out things that keep the kids in line. But if there are days it still comes home that she's, you know. So, verse 4. Also, it will come about in that day that the prophets will each be ashamed of his vision when he prophesies. In other words, when these false prophets are moved by these unclean spirits and they actually do give a prophecy, they're ashamed of those things. Why? Well, because they know they're not supposed to be doing it at that time. They're false prophets. They know they're not supposed to be prophesying falsely. They know that there's judgment coming. They know that their mom and dad may actually bring them up on charges and actually run them through. So they're ashamed of those things. And then it says, and he will not put on a hairy robe in order to deceive. Now, you and I think that's funny, but what did Elijah wear? Hairy robe. What did John the Baptist wear? Hairy robe. This was one of the distinguishing garments of a lot of the prophets, was to put this on. He says, this one, not going to put that on. In other words, apparently in the days leading up to the exile to Babylon, one of the things that the false prophets did to convince people that they were true prophets of God was that they put on these garments. And now you look at that, well, who would dress like that but a prophet? Remember the perspective. This has been a long time because we've been in the Minor Prophets for 2 years. But remember when we started, we looked at some of the characteristics of prophets in the Old Testament. And prophets were kind of looked at as people that were sometimes a little bit batty and a little bit nutty. Well, God had them do some things that were a little out of the ordinary. Lay on one side for a long time, lay on the other side for a long time, get a new belt, stick it in the bank, take it back out, look how it's... I mean, there were just all kinds of things that God had them do. Go about, one prophet had to go about without clothing for a while. One of them had to go around out barefoot, which I can't imagine. And I mean, I just try to walk out across the driveway and with the rocks. I've got tender baby feet. It hurts horribly. I can't imagine in their rocky terrain what that was like. But those were the things God asked their prophets to do. And so here they put on this hairy garment, and everybody goes, oh, it must be a prophet, because who dresses like that? They won't do that. In verse 5, but he will say, this is what the false prophet's going to say, I am not a prophet, I'm a tiller of the ground, or one that serves in the ground, literally. For a man sold me as a slave in my youth. In other words, he's trying to convince other people he's not a prophet, because he doesn't want to die. So in other words, what he's showing is, there's a time coming in which God's going to be causing these people to deal so severely with the false prophets that the ones who are prophets, they're not even going to want to be known as prophets. But apparently, these false prophets don't have the ability to control sometimes what these unclean spirits say through them. That's different than believers. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, Paul says that a prophet in the church, he is able to control. Oh, it's just people stopping in the street. Yeah, it's our neighbors and their daughter. He says that the prophets have the ability to control their spirit. In other words, if one prophet's prophesying and God reveals something to another prophet, then this prophet over here, he could shut up and let this one talk. Because the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. In other words, the spirits are serving, they're giving you revelation, and they don't just take in the church, they just didn't take control of a mouth and just cause a person to just blurt out a prophecy. That person actually could control that. Apparently in the Old Testament with unclean spirits, they were kind of like demons that spoke through the people when Christ walked the earth. They weren't always in control of themselves. So these people are trying to make themselves not look like they're prophets. But they apparently are still kind of doing this secretly and on the side. And he goes on to say in verse 6, and one will say to him, what are these wounds between your arms? And the word arms is literally between the palms of your hand. Now, there are some people that have gone back in history and they've taken this to be a reference to Jesus Christ and what happened to him. But it's more likely that this is talking about wounds that have been inflicted. When it says between your arms, beating up the arms across the chest and across the back is what this is. And this word wound is not the word piercing that we had in the last chapter where they will look on me whom they have pierced. This is a word from naka in the Hebrew. Naka is a word, you all can remember naka as a Hebrew word because you knock on wood. You smite it, you strike it. That's what the word means. It means to smite or to strike. So, knock on wood, naka. Okay. There are times words that you actually can have some mnemonic devices to remember Hebrew words. But that's one of them. And this word means struck.
So they're slashing themselves?
Well, apparently themselves. Hitting themselves, beating themselves, leaving wounds. Very similar to what the priests of Baal did when Elijah challenged the priests of Baal. And remember, the priests of Baal came out and they all went up Mount Carmel and they put up the two altars and the guys were slashing themselves and blood was running all over. It's one of the things that those people did. Self-mutilation is not uncommon among religions not associated with God, which, by the way, says something to some about, especially about some of the monastic orders within Catholicism, where you'd have monks that would go about and self-flagellate themselves with whips and sticks, or sometimes they would walk in lines where each monk would beat the back of the monk in front of him or beat him on the head, and then they would have to, just like bikers would draft, the front one would go to the back, and then he would take his turn, and they'd take walks, and they'd go around and beat each other like that. Because they felt that he needed to mortify the flesh by beating the daylights out of it, as if that really helps. All of that then, verses 1 through 6 are talking about the fact that God is going to cleanse out of the land idolatry, false prophets, and the unclean spirits. This is what he's doing during Daniel's 70th week. He's not doing this, and he's doing this most of this right towards the end of Daniel's 70th week. He's not doing this in the millennial kingdom because there are no unclean spirits in the millennial kingdom. And as a result, there's no false prophets unless you get some faker that just gets up and utters a false prophecy just out of his own noggin, which is, I think, sometimes what you do get with people that pass themselves off as prophets today. Although there may be some false prophets today that actually are moved by demons, potentially. But he's getting them out of there. Then we come back to verse 7, or come down to verse 7, and it says, oh, by the way, we didn't finish the man. He's asked in verse 6, what are those wounds between your hands or your arms? And he says, these are the wounds in the house of my friends. In other words, apparently among my friends or with my family, I was beaten like this. So this is the beating I got at home. This is what Dad did to me. I must have been a real rascal. Something to that effect is what he's saying. In other words, he's trying to say, these aren't self-inflicted, which they are. Verse 7 then. Then he says, awake, O sword, against my shepherd. So now God is calling a sword to awake against his shepherd. And against the man, my associate, my friend, declares the Lord of hosts, strike the shepherd that the sheep may be scattered, and I will turn my hand against the little ones. Now this is where he changes and he looks from the false prophets to the real prophet. Jesus Christ was a prophet. Moses tells us this in the book of Deuteronomy. It's quoted in, let me find my verse here if you want to write it down. Oh, next page. I'll be on the next page. Acts chapter 3, Acts 3:23 and Acts 7:37, both are quoted, references that are quoted from Deuteronomy, where Moses said that God will raise up a prophet for you like me. And it's applied in both Acts 3 and Acts 7 to Jesus Christ. He is that prophet. And the thing is when Jesus walked the earth, that was one of the things that the Jews said. Is this the prophet? Because they were expecting this prophet like Moses that was going to rise up. So Jesus was this real prophet. Now, how did the people respond to the real prophet? Well, they responded to him with hostility. In fact, what God the Father says here in verse 7 is, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd." Now, this brings us, we know Jesus Christ is called the shepherd. It's actually referred to as a shepherd in the Old Testament. John chapter 10 refers to him as a shepherd. Hebrews chapter 13 refers to him as a shepherd. So he's a shepherd in several different places. He's even referred to previously in the book of Zechariah. We saw that he was also looked at as a shepherd in contrast to the false or bad shepherds of Israel in that context. But when God does this, if you flip over in your Bibles to Isaiah 53, take a look at a couple of passages that help us to kind of get this perspective. Isaiah 53 in verse 10. When Jesus Christ was on the cross, it tells us in verse 10, it says, "But the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting into grief that if he would render himself as a guilt offering, then he would actually see his offspring and he would prolong his days." In other words, if he die, he'll live again. It's essentially what he's saying. How do you see your offspring? If you render up your life to die, then how do you see your offspring? It implies you have to live again. And how do you prolong your days if you die? It implies you have to live again. And so, this isn't the only place, but it's indicating resurrection. But it says in the first part that the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. Now, what happened was men mistreated Jesus Christ. They took him, gave him an unjust trial, mistreated him. In the course of the trial, beating him on a couple of different occasions, Pilate had him scourged at length, thinking that that would appease the people. Hey, if we get him scourged and the people let him go, well, that wasn't enough. They wanted him dead. And so you can look at it, this was all attributed to people, but it's also in what they were doing, they were accomplishing God's purpose. And here God was the one that was actually crushing him, because God was the one that laid down the sins. God didn't beat him. God didn't drive the nails into his wrists or into his feet. God didn't put the crown of thorns on his head. God wasn't doing that. Men were doing that. But God was the one that laid the sins upon him and crushed him in that way. And that happened within the context of what they were doing. Now, we've seen this over in the book of Acts. We're not going to go there right now, but we've seen it in Acts where we're told that everything they did to Jesus, Herod, Pontius Pilate, and your leaders, all of them, they did those things exactly as God planned, each and every step. In fact, it says that God actually set out the boundaries that all those things would take place with him. And they did exactly what God determined. So what they did to him was planned by God. God did not look through time and see what they would do and then wrote it down. God planned it. That's why they did it in that way, because that's how God planned to provide salvation. He didn't provide salvation by checking to see, well, let's see how they, well, let's work salvation out of that. God doesn't work like that. So when he says in verse 7, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd." So the sword rises against him. That's what the shepherd is going to do. Now, notice he switches. He's not talking about the prophets now, the false prophets. He's talking about the shepherd. And against the man, my associate, my, I'm trying to get this straight. Literally, literally the strong man that is with me, the strong one that's with me in this. Says Jehovah of hosts. And then he goes on, to strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. This is Jesus Christ quotes this in Matthew chapter 26. Well, let's go over to Matthew 26 and look what happens in Matthew 26. Matthew 26, begin with verse 26. It says, and while they were eating, Jesus took some bread, and after blessing, he broke it, gave it to the disciples, and take, eat, this is my body. When he had taken the cup and given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, drink from it, all of you. For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for forgiveness of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine from now on, until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. And after singing a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives, and Jesus said to them, you will all fall away because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. And then, of course, Peter says, well, all may fall away. Depart. I will never do that. And Jesus reminds him again in verse 34, before the cock crows, you'll deny me three times. The striking of the shepherd is reference to the taking of Jesus and the abuse and everything that he suffers, and it causes the disciples, the 11 that are left, causes them to scatter. But with that, the 11 disciples turn out to be a picture of the scattering of Israel. Because at this time, we're not talking church now. We're talking about scattering these sheep in this context. We're talking about the sheep of Israel, that fold. And this is exactly what God was going to do, and it was going to scare these 11 disciples so that they would scatter. After the resurrection, they're going to come back and they're going to be bold, and they're not going to be afraid anymore. We've been seeing that in Acts. Peter and John are bold afterwards. Apparently James, Ben just went over with us with this this last week. James was, remember, the only disciple that the Bible actually specifically tells you how he was put to death, that he was put to death at the hand. Jesus foretells the death of Peter, and Paul foretells his death, but you don't know what they died, exactly how they died. We have church history that tells us, but the Bible doesn't tell us. We get the idea that Peter was crucified because Jesus says, they will lead you where you do not want to go, and they will stretch your arms out. Stretch you out. So Peter was crucified. Paul was a Roman citizen, which is why he was beheaded. James wasn't a Roman citizen, but because it happened at the hand of Herod, he was beheaded there. James must have been a significant enough character. But then what did Jesus refer to James and his brother John by? What title? You guys remember Ben's class?
What?
Sons of Thunder.
Sons of Thunder.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't call that to a couple of milk toasts, a couple of guys that, what do you want? What would you like to do? You know, those kids that I'm going, what? I can't hear you. Speak up. James and John were not wimps. They spoke loudly. But at this moment, because of what Jesus was enduring, they were scattered. The sword came down on Jesus and they all went running for cover. Very important to understand what this is referred to. You know what Jesus was referred to? And then this becomes a picture of the nation of Israel, which the breast of Zechariah, if you go back to Zechariah 13, is going to indicate that this is what's going to happen with the rest. It says, so strike the shepherd that the sheep might be scattered. And then it says, and I will turn my hand then against the little ones. What are the little ones that God turns his hand against? or some of your Bibles there have, I turn it upon them. But usually it's that al preposition, usually it's against them. That's talking about the rest of the Jews when they're going to be struck by God beginning in 70 AD, and the Jews are actually scattered. Now, there are some Jews that stay in the land. Even when Israel was under the control of the Arab control in the Middle Ages, when the Crusades took place, most of us don't realize that. But Jews and Arabs and Christians were all living in Jerusalem, and they were getting along. They were next door neighbors. They conducted business. The Jews just weren't in control, like they are now, sort of Jerusalem. They all lived together in that area. Now, that's not saying there were tons of Jews there, but there were quite a few Jews that still lived in Jerusalem and in that near vicinity. But most of the nation of Israel, because of what ended up happening, most of them ended up being scattered. A lot of them had already been scattered in 722 BC under the Assyrian, what happened to the Assyrian Empire. These things are being written at this time, if you remember, where this is being written about 516. So this is later. And so some of them have been scattered for a long time, but he's looking at the scattering of the rest of the nation. Verse 8, and it will come about in all the land, declares the Lord. So now he's looking at this land, Israel's, the future places, looking at, we're talking about Daniel's 70th week, is what most of this has been about, that two parts in it will be cut off and perish. And we have other scriptures that tell us that God is going to purge out the dross from Israel. Flip over to Ezekiel for a second. Go over to Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel 20, and he's looking at Israel as a flock in this time. He says in let's go back up. We'll start in verse 33. As I live, declares the Lord God, surely with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, and with fury poured out, I will be king over you. So I'm going to be king by force. And I will bring you out from the peoples and gather you from the lands where you are scattered with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with fury that is poured out. So I'm bringing you back into the land of Israel. And I will bring you into the wilderness of the peoples, and there I will enter into judgment with you face to face. So he's bringing them right there. God's going to deal with them in judgment. He's not going to judge them out there. They've been in judgment scattered among the nations. But now he says, I'm going to judge you face to face. I'm bringing you back here. Verse 36, as I entered into judgment with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt. What happened when he dealt with them in the wilderness of the land of Egypt? The corpses of everybody 20 years old and up dropped in the desert with the exception of Joshua and Caleb and his family. Verse 37, and I will make you pass under the rod. You and I don't get this because we don't raise sheep and goats. But for them, you had animals, and when you were bringing them into your fold, you had your rod there, and you'd hold your rod. And if you had them coming up and you had one that you didn't want to enter into the fold, what would you do? All you had to do was lower your rod and push that sheep away. So I'm going to cause you to pass under the rod. I will bring you into the bond of the covenant, and I will purge from you the rebels. And he talked about the rebels back in verses 7 and 8. The ones that rebelled, that didn't listen to them because they were involved in idolatry. Same thing we're talking about in Zechariah 13. So I'm going to purge away the rebels. And those who transgress. How do they transgress? They're breaking the law by going into idolatry. And I will bring them out of the land where they sojourn, but they will not enter the land of Israel. Thus you will know that I am the Lord. So I'm going to bring you down here. I'm bringing you out of those other peoples. But when it actually comes right down to this, let's put it this way. They're going to come back to the land. And in the process of being in that land area, God's going to enter into judgment with them. And they're going to, some of them are going to be scattered. 144,000 are going to go out through the world. Those are believers. The rest of them go out into the wilderness where there's divine protection. But out in that wilderness, when he takes them, God personally enters into judgment with them. so that when they come into the land at the end of the millennial kingdom, the rebels don't go into the millennial kingdom. They're purged out. How many are purged out? According to Zechariah chapter 8, it says two parts in it will be cut off. A third will be left. He's going to reduce the population by two-thirds. But think about that. What does God do on the face of the earth during the tribulation period of Daniel's 70th week? Through some of the events that take place, a third of the world's population falls. Third. Isn't it a third? Or is it a quarter? I don't remember. It's been a while since I've read that in Revelation, but it's a lot of people. And that's just in that series of events. There's other series of events in which there's a lot of other people that die. Well, we're
4 billion or 6 billion?
Oh, no. Almost at 7 billion right now.
That'd be almost two.
That's a lot of people. So this is what he does, and it says, and I will bring the third part then, the remnant. I will bring them through the fire, refine them as silver is refined, test them as gold is tested, and they will call on my name. Unlike the false prophets in the preceding context that were involved with idols, unclean spirits, these will call on my name. I will answer them, and I will say, they are my people. And they will say, the Lord is my God. They're going to recognize. By the time you get done, God's removed all the rebels, all those that will not, that do not willingly turn, those that even when they've been faced with judgment, they don't want to acknowledge that God's their God. Maybe they want to be, what's the modern term for religions and everybody getting along today? Coexistence, but there's another word, and I'm just drawing a color. Fine, you're in college. What do they call about when all the religions you all get along? It's coexist, yeah, it's one of the words, but I'm just drawing a plurality, pluralism, that's what it is, pluralism. Pluralism is the belief that we can have all these religions, we can all coexist, and pluralism's fine. You have your God, you have my, because in the end, aren't we all worshiping the same God in one way or another? Isn't that the way it all is? You know, it's like the pastor that from the church that Peg grew up in, that Methodist church had told me the kingdom of God's like the city of Jerusalem. It's got a wall around it with many gates. Everybody comes in through their own gate, their own way. And that's the way a lot of people see it in the world. And they look at you. Remember what Jesus said to the Samaritan woman? Salvation is of the Jews. That's pretty arrogant to say salvation is of the Jews. That's not true anymore. Now, salvation is of Christianity. It's of the church. Why? Well, because Judaism rejected Jesus Christ. Will in the future it be of the Jews again? No, it will be of the Jews again. It just isn't at the present time because, as Paul says in Romans, they being ignorant of the righteousness of God went about to establish their own righteousness of God. They don't know God. There's zeal, but there's a zeal with ignorance. They don't know God. So he's looking at a time in the future which... And the reason he enters into judgment with here is because he scatters the sheep by striking Christ. That scatters Israel. Now he brings them back, he's telling us in this context, and he refines them. But in the process of doing that, he refines some so that they're right. The rest of them are purged away. And you have one third that are left that come into this. Just looking to see if there's anything else. Okay. Any questions? We had two questions that went along with this, and it was very simply, what will be the attitude towards false prophets in the future? That was question number one that we had in our worksheet. What's going to be the attitude towards false prophets?
Well, they're not going to want to make it known. They're going to try to hide it and be ashamed. Yeah, that's right.
Ashamed, yeah. They'll be ashamed of them. Very simple.
Themselves.
They're ashamed of themselves. They're ashamed of their own prophecy. And the other people are ashamed of them and put them to death. And then the second one, which deals with what happens in verse 7 and following, the second question is, why does Jehovah instruct men to strike the shepherd? Because it scatters the sheep. In other words, by rejecting their shepherd, their king. And how did they reject? Did Israel reject Christ as a savior? No. They rejected him as a shepherd, as a king. That's what they rejected him as. And by rejecting him as a king, he did become a savior. But in so doing, it caused the sheep to be scattered. Any questions?
Okay, the one third. Okay, so there's one third left. That's as they're ushering into the millennial kingdom.
At the end of Daniel's 70th week, that's how many he purges. But that's
all believers then.
Yes, and we actually have that in Romans 11. It says, "And so all Israel will be saved." In other words, by the time God is done dealing with all the judgment on Israel, all Israel will be saved. Yeah.
There's one place where it says there will be one man for every 8 or 10 women.
There'll be 7 women that will come to one man and says, let us be your wives. We'll even make our own bread and make our own clothes. Just let us have your name. In other words, we'll earn our own living. You won't have to pay anything for us. They don't want to be shamed as being without a husband. And if you have 7 for every 1, it's just showing you how many men have died.
But at that same time, God's resurrecting all the other Jews. This is right. Kind of the.
So we're just talking about just the living Jews, because in the resurrection, nobody marries or is given in marriage in resurrection.
Well,
so.
For the ones going to heaven, but that's in heaven. But this is during the.
Well, no, nobody in resurrection marries. Jesus Christ said that. He says in the resurrection, nobody marries.
So the ones resurrected go in the land?
They go into the land, but they don't marry in the land. They don't marry or anything, the ones that are resurrected.
So it's just the ones that were...
Just the ones coming out of Daniel 7th week. But remember, there's Gentiles that are coming out too, and in the world at that time. So.
There's Egyptians.
Yeah. Well, let's close with a word of prayer. Our Father, again, we're thankful for the time you've given us together, and a reminder that you take very seriously the worship, your worship, and when there are people that have fostered idolatry, the worship of false gods, and have even done so through false prophets. You take that seriously, and there's a day coming in which you are really going to bring judgment on those that have encouraged idolatry through false prophecy. And the nation of Israel, in part, is even enduring part of that judgment at the present time. We look forward to that time in which, having purged them, they will enter into that kingdom, and we, too, will get to participate and see things that are going on as we rule with your Son. And so as we look at these things, we're just thankful for your faithful work with your people, Israel. And how that will, some of that will even relate to us in the future. Amen.
Where's that passage?